Thanks for joining us for this episode of Just Around the Corner with Dennis Mansfield, a podcast developed to challenge your thinking, expand your horizons, and provide a little adventure along the way as we do so. Maybe even add a little humor for you, for my guests, and for me, as together we head just around the corner. Today's guest is Mr. Michael Borner, the founder of three startup tech companies and one faith-based 501c3 nonprofit. I've asked Michael to stay for two episodes, and he's agreed. The first episode will focus on how a person takes an idea and then, through community, turns it into reality. The second episode will focus on why Michael Borner has pursued this for his entire life. Michael Borner is a loving husband, a father of four beautiful daughters, and the grandfather of one terrific little granddaughter.
Thank you for joining Just Around the Corner with Dennis Mansfield. As John Hay, one of the most famous men of the 19th century, once said, "All the great prizes in life are just around the corner." Let's go there together.
Welcome to the podcast, Michael Borner. Honored to have you with us today.
Thank you, man. So good to be here.
Tell you what, you and I have known each other for 30 plus years.
Yes.
Almost like brothers. Mm-hmm. Going through all that we've done. So my opportunity to actually interview you today is really for the benefit of those that don't know you. Mm. So some of my questions, you're going to go, "Dennis, you already know that."
Of course I think you know everything here.
Well, I don't know if I know everything. But I'll tell you what, I do know a lot, and I expect to find out some fun things from you today. Michael, for the sake of those that are not aware of Michael Borner and the things that you have done, give an overview of your bio.
Yeah, sure. Well, first, it's a joy to be with you. Mm-hmm. And I've been amazed by the level of your contribution on so many levels, from family to policy to the political landscape to the kingdom. Just amazing. So it's a joy to be here with someone I have admired and loved for, gosh, almost 35 years. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, I was blessed to be born here in the Treasure Valley and graduated from Borah High School in 1983. Just had our 40-year celebration this summer.
Dude, you're an old man.
Yes, a lot more gray, a whole lot more miles on the car. But, you know, I was blessed to be raised in a family that, you know, loved me. We definitely had some challenges. My parents were divorced when I was about seven. Mm-hmm. And went on to be raised by primarily a single mom who was just extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing what happens when you have a very encouraging, precious parent that loves you and inspires your dreams. And then ended up going off to college in Phoenix, Arizona to study computer science. For some reason, as a kid, I wanted to be president of IBM.
That was your goal.
I got that idea or why, but I thought, okay, computer science, and this is back in the 80s, you know, before we had computers on every desk, and then something extraordinary happened. I ended up dating a Christian gal. I was raised in a faith-based home, but it was an environment where it was more around the efforts and the works of your energies, and I got really face-to-face with this concept of grace after dating this gal who was actually raised Jewish, and she had gone to the Miss USA pageant and had done really well in that world and had met her in Phoenix, and we hit it off and started dating, and then I was trying to convert her over to what I believed and almost had her, but
she was a Jewish Christian.
She was a Jewish Christian, yeah, and she was raised in Southern California. I had never heard of the term JAP before, J-A-P.
Jewish American Princess.
Exactly, yes. So she was one of those.
Ah, okay.
And, you know, what does a JAP order for dinner? Reservations. So it's a funny little culture to learn. But she was an amazingly godly, on-fire Christian. And she was trying to convince me and ended up forcing me to go to a Christian church. And one day we were sitting in the sanctuary, and she filled out this little note card in the back of the pew and then put it in this thing that went by. And went, "I wonder what that was and what's going to happen."
Because in your culture, you didn't have things that went by like that.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with what that process was. And if I remember right, I can't remember if she did this or threatened to do it, to write suicidal on the card to ensure it would get attention. Right, you know. And so two nights later on Tuesday night, we get this knock on the door. I did. And someone actually wasn't home, but they left a really nice note saying, hey, thanks for visiting our church. We'd love to have you come to a Wednesday night Bible study. And so I went, Wednesday night Bible study. I wonder what they're going to do there. So I'm looking at this thing going, if I go to this, it'll cause tremendous points with this girlfriend.
Oh.
And so that was my only motivation for attending. So I went to the Wednesday
night. Glad it was pure.
Yes, the motivation of a pretty girl when you're 20-something. So ended up,
I love that.
Long story short, went through and met the pastor afterwards. And I just said, hey, you know, I'm kind of got a different religious faith. I'm just kind of looking around. Mm-hmm. And didn't tell him about the girlfriend reason. Mm-hmm. And he said, hey, I'd really like you to be introduced to someone who kind of has a similar background that you do. And he shared a number of things with me, and he said, I don't want you to believe anything I've told you.
This is the person that had this similar background.
Correct.
This friend introduced you to him,
mm-hmm.
and he began by saying he didn't want to influence you.
Yeah, well, he told me a number of things that he believed, but he said, I don't want you to believe or trust anything I've said. You need to study this for yourself. And then he said this phrase. He said, but know this, truth never fears investigation. There was something about that that resonated in my soul. I just went, wow, I really believe that, that that's true. And so I started looking more deeply and into what I'd been raised with and began to find and realize, especially through the influence of this gal and a number of other Christians, that this concept of grace, this concept that Jesus is actually God, that the Trinity is this amazing, you know, kind of theological understanding of who God is, but... Yeah. The major shift was that you don't have to earn your way into a relationship or into a salvation or into your heavenly future, that you actually have to accept it and receive it as a gift. Mm-hmm. And that was very hard for me to believe, hard for me to understand, and very counter to what I'd been, you know, taught growing up. And so I had such high respect for the people that I was raised with, and this was a very interesting kind of breaking of, wow, how do I deal with my own theological perspective on this? But as they walked me through the Bible and the New Testament, it's not by our good works. It's by his gift.
Well, and if it were by our good works, what was the cross all about?
Right, yeah. So that was what was transformative to me. And so when I became a Christian, accepted Christ and the pastor that had reached out to me and befriended me, we became best friends. Pastor Lane Franks is his name that you know well. Mm-hmm. And we're, gosh, I don't know, close to 38 years into a precious friendship and relationship. And we became roommates for 3 years. We were both single. He discipled me. And that's when I decided, you know what? I want to figure out how to take this grace-based message and scale it. It was one of those things like, do people know about this thing? This is so awesome. We ought to get this out to everyone.
I remember when the Bible talks about things falling from our eyes.
Yes.
Sometimes it's metaphorical. In one case, it was actually something that fell from the Apostle Paul's eyes onto the ground. Like, yeah. He could see. And I remember thinking a very similar thought. Does anybody else know about this?
Right.
And if not, why not?
Yeah, this is the best deal in the world.
Yeah.
And in exchange for all of your sin, your debt, you get someone else's perfect A+ test score that you get to receive just by asking.
Yeah.
And that was the piece that I really had to get my head around and realized that this is truly this scenario of exchanging your guilt for someone else's perfection. Mm-hmm. And of course, the whole theology of Christ and the cross is an amazing scenario. But somebody explained it to me. It's much like a wedding where two people get married. And you ask someone, hey, do you know if you're married? Pretty easy answer. And if you go, okay, how do you know you're married? Well, on this date, on this time, I said I do. Mm-hmm. And it's actually very easy. Mm-hmm. You find out if you're going to get divorced, just how married you are by saying I do.
How difficult it is.
So, and that was the beauty of that exchange to realize, wow, on some date at some time, you say, Jesus, I believe that you're real. And I'm a person who needs forgiveness, and I accept you and your perfection in exchange for my debt. And when you ask him to be your savior, that's the essence of Christianity. And then you go on to do the good works and so forth because you want to.
And because they flow naturally from you. I will say, though, that when you were a young man, a kid, you were shown a great deal of drive and goal setting. Mm-hmm. And you were a junior entrepreneur when you were a kid. Mm. Talk about some of that, because on the one hand, you're in your 20s, you come to this awareness of grace, unmerited favor. Mm. But on the other hand, you're still the Michael who worked your tail off and made money. Mm. Talk to us about those early years when you were a kid. What kind of things did you do that earned money, that gave you that, oh, I can succeed?
Yeah. Well, you know, being raised in that kind of a great family, you're taught to work hard. And, you know, I think my first job besides the paper route was washing dishes at El Gringo, you know, with the hot water and no gloves and, you know, no machine. And so you come home smelling like a taco every night. But the ability to work hard was never, you know, an issue. But there was always something I enjoyed as a young person to get people to come together and do things that you couldn't do alone. Mm-hmm. And so, and according to the statistics, they say about 15% of the population has kind of a natural initiative gene, kind of a gift to just take initiative. They're the ones that kind of pull everybody together, the ones that, hey, let's all do something, and somebody calls all their friends, and for whatever reason, that was kind of me. Mm-hmm. And hey, let's do bike jumps outside. You know, let's get everybody, a big crowd, and we'll put a ramp, and everybody can jump their bikes, and it'll be kind of fun. So they've always enjoyed getting people to do something together. And just entrepreneurially, in high school, they used to have these leaderboards where you could actually sell advertising for business space. And so I said, I can do that. Mm-hmm. And so that started to generate some money. And then,
so you actually go to businesses as a high school student, mm-hmm. sell them space on it,
right,
and then make a commission off of it.
Correct, right. And so, you know, just early on, how could you make money? And I think everybody in their, you know, early years wants to go off and make great money and
sure.
be wealthy, et cetera. But there was just always this kind of desire to do things where you needed to pull together people to do things together. Mm-hmm. And so, and then, I, you know, as I moved to Phoenix to go to school, I was waiting tables, you know, like many do. And then I'm a waiter and coming up with entrepreneurial ways to improve processes. And for some reason, I've just always seen this. How do you make things better? Mm-hmm. How do you create radical process improvement? Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, as a waiter, it was like, hey, this is a giant Italian restaurant called Spats. And it was way far, so developed sign language, because all the people on the staff, most of them were Hispanic and couldn't speak English. Mm. And I couldn't speak Spanish. And so we developed, let's do hand signals so we can speed this whole process up. And then I was working for Mattel on the side a little bit for doing some things with them, and developed this little tip tray, because you come and, hey, you'd rather check out an array. We're still, so I developed this little cool thing where you could flip a button and lights would come on to alert you when it's time to build that. And you know, filed up the patent on that, which I don't think went anywhere.
How old were you at that time?
I was probably 19.
19. Per se. Yeah. Filing patents. Yeah. With an entrepreneurial zeal.
Yeah. I just was raised in kind of environment where what else could work?
Yeah, yeah.
How else could you do things? Don't take no for an answer.
Yeah.
Press in, figure it out.
When you were going through school, what kind of classes fed that fire inside of you, both in high school and in college?
Yeah, I don't think any of them.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think there's really any classes that really spawned any type of fostering of an entrepreneurial scenario. I mean, I was an okay student. I wasn't a great mm-hmm. student. I was an athlete. You know, played football all from, you know, grade school to high school, mm-hmm. and so that taught me a whole lot about discipline and about hard work and pushing your body past the point of vomiting, so you can figure out how to, you know,
keep going,
go through that difficulty, but. Yeah, I mean, you know, school was enjoyable, but there was really not a lot of things in the average classroom, at least back in the 80s, that really kind of drew you out. This is way before, you know, app stores and concepts of the gig economy. And so kind of the entrepreneurial thing, I think, came more from, you know, family.
But something came about, as I remember, you had the acting bug bite you. Hmm. And you made a decision that you'd like to be involved in some form of video or film. Tell us about that. How does a young kid without any acting experience find himself suddenly on a set?
Yeah. Well, again, girl motivated, I think was the truth. And I'm in Phoenix, and there's a giant mall there called the Biltmore. And we'd heard on the radio, because radio is an amazing medium to communicate, and I listened to it. And they were going to have Eileen Ford come to this big mall in Phoenix and do a giant runway show in the outdoor, beautiful kind of mall area. And we thought, hey, they're going to do kind of a model search there. There'll be lots of girls there. So get a couple of friends from school and let's go down there. And then when you got there, you found out, hey, if anybody wanted to actually come up and walk the runway from the crowd.
Really?
They let you do that.
A little karaoke walking.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like, okay, so I'll do that. If I get up here, even more visibility for finding a date. So
not just visibility, but highlighting.
So for whatever reason, I was dumb enough to go do that. And so I got up on this long runway, kind of a New York runway, you know, fashion show, whatever I was wearing. And for whatever reason, apparently whatever I did was attractive enough where Eileen Ford herself put a star on my little application. So I got followed up with the modeling company, I think a week after that happened. And they said, hey, we think you've got some real possibilities, so you could come in and get some training. And so next thing you know, I'm in there with Plaza 3 Models and doing this work. I'm like, wait a minute, so you pay me to go walk on a runway with some cool clothes. So you pay me to go audition for Ray-Ban, which like 500 people came in. I happened to wear Ray-Ban, so I came in, did the photos, and I got selected.
And you got selected.
And then I got to go up on the ski mountain with a couple of beautiful gals and wear Ray-Bans and ski and be paid $500 in the 80s for the day.
That's a lot of money.
And, you know, then doing more and more newspaper and commercials and all kinds of different things. So it was a fun time. I will tell you, be careful about your initiative because I got hired to do runway a decent amount, and I think it was Dillard's back then. And I was also a gymnast growing up, and so I could do a standing backflip, among other things. And so
that's
impressive
with tight jeans on, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I thought, you know what, this would be fun. So I've got these two girls, we'll do our walk, and I told them, hey, let's do this. We'll go to the end, and then we'll walk back together. I'll turn around, I'll do a standing backflip, and then we'll just walk off together. So, okay, so I did that. And the whole crowd applauded. It was like they'd never seen a backflip before. And I was instantly fired.
Really?
They're like, who told you to do that? We didn't ask you to do that. That does not represent our brand. We don't do backflips during runway shows.
A learned lesson at that moment about brand.
Yeah, so a little too much testosterone and energy for that moment. But
well, you were in a couple videos. You're involved in some shoots that occurred, and that walk us through that. I remember one, and I don't know whether it was after you had this epiphany of faith in your life, but it was the most remarkable thing. I saw you when you wore a younger man's clothes, walking up as if you were an angel sorts.
Right.
It was a strange,
I forgot about that,
but wonderful video.
Yeah.
What happened? How did you get that role?
Well, I had met the people at Mars Hill Productions that do these amazing Christian films, and so the founder of it said, hey, I'd like to cast you as an angel in this movie. And so I got cast, a nice big wig, and this really kind of amazing set of scenes where I think I was like an Archangel Michael or something like that. And so
typecasting with your name.
Yeah, I guess so. So just, you know, more of those kind of opportunities to be able to be in that space. And it was always just a thrilling opportunity to be able to serve and to use kind of energy and creativity. But then after I became a Christian, I got really a whole lot more interested in producing content and getting behind the camera.
Yeah, I was going to say, you went from being in front of the camera to being behind it.
Right.
Not just producing, but directing as well.
Right.
And so what was the moment in time where you thought, I can get behind the camera and I can have a greater influence?
Yeah, you know, it was that intersection between coming to Christ and finding this grace message that was this big secret. It's like, why do people not know about this? And then it was like, how do we scale this? What's the best method? So I didn't have a particular love of media at all. It was wait a minute, let's use the tools that can get this out to the most people possible. And back then, you know, in 89, 90, 91, the key tools, it's hard for people to kind of remember before the internet, but it was television. It was print. It was billboards. It was the ability to put things on broadcast television on NBC and CBS. It was the opportunity to put outdoor billboards where those were the main mediums that would influence culture. And so that was the desire to go, okay, I want to study film. So that's when I decided to switch my major and to go, okay, I want to study filmmaking. And that I got accepted to Biola University to go and finish my degree and study film so I could go into ministry and use media. But right at that time, something pretty devastating happened. You know, I mentioned my parents were divorced when I was about seven. But my dad actually came to Christ later in his life. But he was he owned his own company and very successful at what he did. But he struggled with alcohol and dealt with alcoholic issues and got finished with that. Was remarried and went through some major family circumstances that were very, very difficult. And he went back and drank. Mm-hmm. And then went back and drank again and ended up getting 2 DUIs. Mm-hmm. And I got a phone call one night. I was actually in Tucson. I was working at my job at the Yellow Pages at the time. Mm-hmm. And drove up, I'll never forget, back to Phoenix to go and vote on the next, it was a Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And my roommate, Lane Franks, I walked in the door and he just put his arms around me. And he said, sorry to tell you, your father's passed away. And my dad had this extraordinary amount of pressure and opened his Bible, put it on his chest, and I just took his 9mm handgun and put it to his head and took his life. Mm. And that was a really defining and difficult moment.
So sorry.
But that is what brought me back up to Boise to come to the funeral. I brought my Baptist pastor to preach the funeral, and people came to Christ there. And I'll never forget the moment when I walked in and saw his body for the first time. In the funeral home, Lane and I were typical, 20-somethings that had a beautifully decorated apartment. Mm-hmm. Not, wasn't decorated at all. It was like one Hawaii poster that was sideways, and then we had this other picture that I'd found and put up, and it was this beautiful picture of this gorgeous rock mountain, mm-hmm. and it had this quote that was just powerful. It said something along the lines of, "Our faith does not rest in our feelings, but in the unshakable character of Jesus Christ."
Yes.
And that image was the same image that was above my father's casket when I turned the corner to see. It was just this kind of moment of encouragement.
What an encouragement, Michael.
Yeah. So that's what brought me back to Idaho, and that's when we started the ministry to use media to get the gospel out and get the churches to work together.
Now, that was Mission Media mm-hmm. when you birthed that. We're going to talk about that. In fact, I'm honored to have you for 2 episodes.
Yeah.
On the podcast, and we'll get to that because I want to know the importance of that, not only in your life and the lives of people, that I saw firsthand that Mission Media touched. Mm. But your entrepreneurial zeal was always there. Mm. You spent a period of time with Mission Media, mm-hmm. and then you decided that you wanted to go into business. Mm-hmm. Now that was a It's kind of an uncommon thing. Most times, yes. you hear about business people who become pastors mm-hmm. or business people that become missionaries. But you went from being a pastoring missionary into business. What moved you in that direction?
Well, it was really the circumstances. And, when you get into any type of entrepreneurial venture, you have to have, first of all, I think, this deep Lewis and Clark craziness. To be willing to take on a journey that is way more difficult.
You don't know where you're going. You have no idea where the miles are in front of you.
And you're a huge student of history, and the book on Lewis and Clark is an extraordinary adventure.
Undaunted.
To read, and that undaunted courage that they had to go do and pull off what they did,
yes.
you have to have that level of, let's go.
Yeah.
Let's put a Bowie knife in our mouth and see what happens, kind of scenario. So I did that on the ministry side, and as a brand new Christian, when I found out that the denominations actually, because I was kind of taught that none of them really agreed on anything. So when I found out that the Assemblies and the Nazarenes and the Baptists agreed on this concept of grace mm-hmm. and the salvation through relationship with Christ that's a free gift, like, cool, do they work together? Not so much, nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah.
So the ministry that we started was designed to get the churches to work together mm-hmm. and create a method, just like the dairymen do, and they chip their money in and pool resources to put it on the media. That's what we did. And so for 15 years, we worked to build a whole strata of strategy that allowed us to be able to put the gospel out in the secular world. And then in 15 years, there were a number of changes in pivotal shifts in the culture and infrastructure that allowed us to move into the internet and put video on the internet. Mm-hmm. And that video on the internet scenario opened up a whole new foray to do some extraordinary things that was then noticed in a heavy way by the medical world and the for-profit corporation space. And so to skip way forward to that, we had developed something that transferred knowledge very effectively. and told stories that we had kind of really figured out ways to master this concept of kind of grabbing the middle of the cinnamon roll, just very concentrated content that you could put together in a short form video.
Now, the middle of a cinnamon roll, you've piqued my curiosity because every time a cinnamon roll comes my way, I move all the excess stuff away and go to the heart of it. Am I the only one? No, apparently not. That's a great word picture.
Yeah.
And that's what you wanted to do with content.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You really need to distill down things into axiomatic, powerful, pithy pieces of content to be consumed. Mm. And when we watch video content or even listen to audio, we want it to be more vetted. And we don't want a lot of fluff. And so we designed a whole methodology to create content that would do just that. And then we started putting content into a sequence we called an arc of engagement. And if you put it on kind of a yellow brick road, it's a phenomenal way to consume content. Well, we had really perfected that in this ministry space, but now the people in the corporate world came knocking because what we'd come up with is a way to solve what we would call the human process bottleneck.
Yeah.
And high-value knowledge gaps, wherever they exist, wherever they occur, it's an expensive, very suboptimal environment.
Oh yeah.
And so someone came along and said, hey, we'd love to see if this could apply into the medical space. And so next thing you know, we're taking meetings with all kinds of extraordinary leaders. And
Without any real basis of your own personal understanding of medical,
I had a deep knowledge of medicine. Zero.
Zero.
We hadn't known anything about medicine. My grandfather was a doctor, but you know, I didn't know anything about medicine.
Yeah.
They said, have you ever considered putting all of these tools and all the storytelling? And it was the ability back in 2005 to summon content with a click of a mouse mm-hmm. on the internet. And people forget, in 2005 and before, it was all dial-up.
Yeah.
It was, you know, these modems that you know, hear the modem sound. And then 256K speeds came out with a major shift. And I think that's what's incredibly important about innovation and business is you have to pay attention to the landscape of the major sea changes that occur that change business models and create huge opportunity. We're seeing that in immense ways now with AI. And so it's this huge burgeoning of opportunity, and an entrepreneurial mind begins to look at how do we get ahead of this and see around the corners. And so we had created this very powerful methodology that would have immense application for people who are just diagnosed with a disease or who are going through a complex surgical set of procedures. So those are huge knowledge gaps, and the only way to fill them effectively is with humans who have a high level of experience and are very expensive with PhDs and MDs, etc. And so, you know, one of the things a doctor is least fond of in their career is taking all that education and explaining freshman level things 30 times a day.
Yeah.
And so by putting these yellow brick roads,
which they have to do repeatedly.
And unfortunately, they don't do it consistently. Mm-hmm. And depending on the mood, it can, you know, change its set. So anyway, the medical space is an extraordinary environment. So they came knocking and we said, listen, we have a deep history in creating content. But this hospital system said, we get it. We love it. This is the future. And then I'll never forget the meeting and said, could you do a surgical library, this whole yellow brick road on bariatric surgery? And I said, absolutely. But one question, what's bariatric surgery? And then they explained, oh, that's the surgery where you, okay. So we went on to create that, and then we ended up landing, and this is where the ministry kind of foray accidentally shifts into the business environment, because at that point we had actually had investors that put their investments into a kingdom scenario, but we wanted to protect their investment and do anything we could to continue that. And so when one of our investors sent over someone from this billion-dollar hospital system, that turned into a $7 million contract to create a whole system of content for cancer, for different surgical, for heart vascular processes.
And over the years, it's expanded into the area of ocular mm-hmm. concerns, into a number of other areas that have been remarkable that, again, you knew nothing about until you had to know everything.
Right.
And what I'm thrilled about, especially as an entrepreneur, and I'd like you to speak to some of the young men, young women that are literally watching this and have an idea that they'd like to start a business. They'd like to see a corporation occur. They'd like to take their idea and blow it up and change the world.
Yeah.
Speak to that young man, that young woman, and give them hope about, yes, you can do it, and it will be hard.
Well, it's true, and we hear that all the time. It's hard, and the huge amount of hours that it takes, which is why the fundamentals are really, really true. You've got to do something you really do love, because the amount of time and energy required, people will give up. And so I think when it comes to entrepreneurialism, having something that you can improve upon, not just a little bit, not evolution, but true radical improvement in an environment can be extraordinary. And I think those are often best done when you have shifts in tech infrastructure, in social movement, you know, behavioral shifts. For example, right now, the biggest three consumer behavioral shifts are the move to mobile first. Mm-hmm. Didn't used to be that way. Now it's mobile first. Secondly, is this addiction to video and also the communication preference of text. Well, that shift created a whole opportunity for us to move a lot of this to mobile. But I think for an entrepreneur, for someone starting out, I think a few things have to be there. I think first, you got to really be honest with yourself. Am I the kind of person that really does have the tenacity and the initiative to drive a process and also to come up to barriers and then go through them? And if you don't have that ability, it really is not probably the right place for you. You probably ought to get with somebody else who has that you can be, because it takes a team. Just like the astronauts, they're very famous, but it's a giant team that makes that entire ecosystem work. But a true entrepreneur, I think like yourself, has to be someone who is tenacious about moving forward. And in addition, I think you've got to be in a position to constantly be learning, paying so much attention to so many things, to read books like crazy, to be with entrepreneurs that you can actually be mentored by, to listen to, because the amount of learning and the build, measure, learn cycles it requires to get where you need to go are just endless. Yeah. And I think it also takes this ability to not take no for an answer.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, that's been kind of one of my traits, which you have to be careful of, and you've actually helped me and our team, because sometimes when you work with a team and you're never take no for an answer, you got to use that on things and not people. And so I think when it comes to entrepreneurial leadership, being able to really do a great job casting vision, but also doing a great job to seek first to understand and being a good listener.
And then be understood.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And if you do it in that order, it's an extraordinary difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you mentioned earlier about your time in sports. Mm-hmm. Walk with me how that football part of you was able to resurface in the tenacity of deciding I've got a startup, I'm going to make this happen, and I am not giving up. Mm. Does someone have to be a sports, you know, kid right. in order to do it, or is it just the principle?
Yeah, no, I don't think they do. I think it's the principle, which is really, how do you keep going when your body says stop? Mm. How do you keep pressing through the pain? How do you mentally develop the toughness to be able to handle the obstacles? Because you get into business, and what's so hard is everybody says it, but until you live it, you don't really, really see it. And an entrepreneurial venture is really like riding a roller coaster, where it's the highest highs and the lowest lows, often multiple times in a day. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary what hits you, and you don't have if you don't have the resiliency, the fortitude, and the ability to press through that. And that's why I really like reading, you know, these books of old pioneers. And, you know, what it took to be able to get through this in the faith and the determination. I was just at a global leadership conference just recently, and they had a great speaker there named Jamie Kerr-Lima. I wrote it down to remember. But Jamie wrote a book called Believe It. Mm. And I'd highly recommend it. It's the story of her going from, you know, coming right out of school to developing a cosmetics line in her own living room. And she had rosacea on her skin, and she just couldn't find really good makeups that would cover it. And then she has this crazy, wacky idea to go, well, why don't I kind of figure out how to formulate my own in her living room?
Amazing.
And then it's the story of how she goes through massive obstacles. Mm-hmm. And she's not the super skinny model. Mm-hmm. She wanted to do something for people kind of more regular.
Sure.
And she goes through this whole process and ends up eventually selling her company to, I think it's L'Oreal, for over $1 billion.
Amazing.
And so, but one of the things that she talks about is the rejection over and over and over and over and over, and the 100-hour weeks. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's usually for the young people, amount of energy. But if you're not willing to hear no, or don't, no way, or there's no way in a million years this will ever happen to you, and if you're not willing to put in the energy, the time, and the hours, Because when you start a venture, you have to bring everybody else into your vision, which means people giving you their money, their hard-earned post-tax money that they're trusting you with. Yeah. The integrity's got to be high, and the work ethic has to be extraordinary.
Yeah.
So it's not easy, but I highly recommend her book. It is a really
good journey. What's the name of it?
Yeah, it's called Believe It.
Believe It.
Yeah, the name of her company was It Cosmetics.
Oh,
and,
that's great.
Great example of someone overcoming massive obstacles.
And Michael, tell us, I know we're coming in for a landing here, but tell us a little bit about your bride, your girls, and your grandbaby.
There's the real joy of life. I have a bride of, it'll be 35 years in March of next year. Wasn't the gal that I dated. She was a bulldog. She was what I needed to win me to Christ. She became a friend. But my precious wife, Natalie, I'll never forget, I met her because my roommate, Lane, said, hey, we should go up to that water ski retreat this other church is having. I said, that's Roosevelt Lake. That's 2 hours from here. I said, what time is it going to be over? It was 4. I said, it's 2 o'clock now. Yeah, but we might meet our wives there. So that actually is what happened. So that's where Natalie and I met and fell in love, and she's the most godly, extraordinary woman. And we have 4 beautiful daughters and 2 sons-in-law. We finally had boys. It took about 25 years.
And they had to marry in rather than birth.
That's right. So we had this beautiful estrogen farm raising these little girls. And being a father of daughters has just been extraordinary. They're amazing, amazing leaders.
But then a grandbaby came in, and you were saying, am I going to have a boy?
So we've been hearing about this grandparent. I'm 58, so I've, you know, got friends, grandparenting world, including yourself. So I finally joined the club.
Yes, you
and,
did.
And about 5 weeks ago, Brittany and Isaac had a little precious baby, Olivia. So she is the joy and now the home screen picture on my phone.
Aww.
So it is such a blessing to see that. And you forget, man, how much work it is to raise a precious little infant. We've all done it, but we've forgotten.
Unbelievable.
And Brittany and Isaac, amazing parents.
Wow. You know, I'd like you to stick around for us to record the next episode.
Yeah.
I'd like to dig into the issue of what Mission Media did then and what its offshoot, renamed Mission 17, is doing now. Mm. Can you stick around for a little bit more?
Be a joy.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, all I can tell you is it is exciting to be next to Michael Borner. And for me to be riding shotgun with him for 32 years, 35 years, to be able to see what he's done, what he's been able to bring together in terms of people who love success. Some are people who love success in Christ. Others are on the journey to find out about success in Christ. And Michael, it is phenomenal. So when we come back for the next episode, join us. I think you'll find it absolutely even more fascinating than today's.